It was certainly a wonderful work of art, and a wonderful likeness as well. "My dear fellow, I congratulate you most warmly," he said. "It is the finest portrait of modern times. Mr. Gray, come over and look at yourself." The lad started, as if awakened from some dream. "Is it really finished?" he murmured, stepping down from the platform. "Quite finished," said the painter. "And you have sat splendidly today. I am awfully obliged to you." "That is entirely due to me," broke in Lord Henry. "Isn't it, Mr. Gray?" Dorian made no answer, but passed listlessly in front of his picture and turned towards it. When he saw it, he drew back, and his cheeks flushed for a moment with pleasure. A look of joy came into his eyes, as if he had recognized himself for the first time. He stood there motionless and in wonder, dimly conscious that Hallward was speaking to him, but not catching the meaning of his words. The sense of his own beauty came on him like a revelation. He had never felt it before. Basil Hallward's compliments had seemed to him to be merely the charming exaggerations of friendship. He had listened to them, laughed at them, forgotten them. They had not influenced his nature. Then had come Lord Henry Wotton with his strange panegyric on life, his terrible warning of its brevity. That had stirred him at the time, and now, as he stood gazing at the shadow of his own loveliness, the full reality of the description flashed across him. Yes, there would be a day when his face would be wrinkled and wizen, his eyes dim and colourless, the grace of his figure broken and deformed. The scarlet would pass away from his lips, and the gold steal from his hair. The life that was to make his soul would mar his body. He would become dreadful, hideous, and uncouth. As he thought of it, a sharp pang of pain struck through him like a knife, and made each delicate fibre of his nature quiver. His eyes deepened into amethyst, and across them came a mist of tears. He felt as if a hand of ice had been laid upon his heart. "Don't you like it?" cried Hallward at last, stung a little by the lad's silence, not understanding what it meant. "Of course he likes it," said Lord Henry. "Who wouldn't like it? It's one of the greatest things in modern art. I will give you anything you like to ask for it. I must have it." "It is not my property, Harry." "Whose property is it?" "Dorian's, of course," answered the painter. "He's a very lucky fellow." "How sad it is," murmured Dorian Gray, with his eyes still fixed upon his own portrait. "How sad it is. I shall grow old and horrible and dreadful. But this picture will remain always young. It will never be older than this particular day of June. If it were only the other way, if it were I who was to be always young, and the picture that was to grow old. For that, I would give everything. Yes, there is nothing in the whole world I would not give. I would give my soul for that." "You would hardly care for such an arrangement, Basil," cried Lord Henry, laughing. "It would be rather hard lines on your work." "I should object very strongly, Harry," said Hallward. Dorian Gray turned and looked at him. "I believe you would, Basil. You like your art better than your friends. I am no more to you than a green bronze figure. Hardly as much, I dare say." The painter stared in amazement. It was so unlike Dorian to speak like that. What had happened? He seemed quite angry. His face was flushed and his cheeks burning. "Yes," he continued. "I am less to you than your ivory Hermes or your silver fawn. You will like them always." "How long will you like me?" "Till I have my first wrinkle, I suppose. I know now that when one loses one's good looks, whatever they may be, one loses everything. Your picture has taught me that. Lord Henry Wotton is perfectly right. Youth is the only thing worth having. When I find that I am growing old, I shall kill myself." Hallward turned pale and caught his hand. "Dorian! Dorian!" he cried. "Don't talk like that. I have never had such a friend as you, and I shall never have another. You are not jealous of material things, are you? You who are finer than any of them." "I am jealous of everything whose beauty does not die. I am jealous of the portrait you have painted of me. Why should it keep what I must lose? Every moment that passes takes something from me and gives something to it. Oh, if it were only the other way, if the picture could change, and I could always be what I am now. Why did you paint it? It will mock me some day, mock me horribly. The hot tears welled into his eyes. He tore his hand away, and, flinging himself on the divan, he buried his face in the cushions, as though he was praying. This is your doing, Harry, said the painter bitterly. Lord Henry shrugged his shoulders. It is the real Dorian Gray, that is all. It is not. If it is not, what have I to do with it? You should have gone away when I asked you, he muttered. I stayed when you asked me, was Lord Henry's answer. Harry, I can't quarrel with my two best friends at once, but between you both you have made me hate the finest piece of work I have ever done, and I will destroy it. But what is it but canvas and colour? I will not let it come across our three lives and mar them. Dorian Gray lifted his golden head from the pillow, and with pallid face and tear-stained eyes looked at him as he walked over to the deal painting table that was sat beneath the high-curtained window. What was he doing there? His fingers were straying about among the litter of tin tubes and dry brushes, seeking for something. Yes, it was for the long palette knife, with its thin blade of lithe steel. He had found it at last. He was going to rip up the canvas. With a stifled sob, the lad leaped from the couch and, rushing over to Hallward, tore the knife out of his hand and flung it to the end of the studio. "Don't, Basil, don't," he cried. "It would be murder." "I am glad you appreciate my work at last, Dorian," said the painter coldly, when he had recovered from his surprise. "I never thought you would." "Appreciate it? I'm in love with it, Basil. It's a part of myself. I feel that. Well, as soon as you are dry, you shall be varnished and framed and sent home. Then you can do what you like with yourself." Crikey. And he walked across the room and rang the bell for tea. "You will have tea with me, of course, Dorian. And so will you, Harry. Or do you object to such simple pleasures?" "I adore simple pleasures," said Lord Henry. "They are the last refuge of the complex. But I don't like scenes, except on the stage. What absurd fellows you are, both of you. I wonder who it was defined man as a rational animal. It was the most premature definition ever given. Man is many things, but he is not rational. I'm glad he is not, after all. Oh, I wish you chaps would not squabble over the picture. You had much better let me have it, Basil. This silly boy doesn't really want it, and I really do. If you let anyone have it but me, Basil, I shall never forgive you," cried Dorian Gray, "and I don't allow people to call me a silly boy. You know the picture is yours, Dorian. I gave it to you before it existed. And you know you've been a little silly, Mr. Gray, and that you don't really object to being reminded that you are actually extremely young." "I should have objected very strongly this morning, Lord Henry." "Ah, this morning. You have lived since then." There came a knock at the door, and the butler entered with a laden tea tray and set it down upon a small Japanese table. There was a rattle of cups and saucers and the hissing of a fluted German urn. Two globe-shaped china dishes were brought in by a page. Dorian Gray went over and poured out the tea. The two men sauntered languidly to the table and examined what was under the covers. "Let us go to the theatre tonight," said Lord Henry. "There is something on somewhere. I have promised to dine at White's, but it is only with an old friend, so I can send him a wire to say that I am ill, or that I am prevented from coming in a consequence of a subsequent engagement. I think that would be a rather nice excuse. It would have all the surprise of candour." "It is such a bore putting on one's dress clothes," muttered Hallward. "And then one has them on. They are so horrid." "Yes," answered Lord Henry dreamily. "The costume of the 19th century is detestable. It is so sombre, so depressing. Sin is the only real colour element left in modern life." "You must not say things like that before Dorian, Harry." "Which before Dorian? The one who is pouring out tea for us, or the one in the picture?" "Before either. I should like to come to the theatre with you, Lord Henry," said the lad. "Then you shall come, and you will come too, Basil, won't you?" "I can't really. I would sooner not. I have a lot of work to do." "Well then, you and I will go alone, Mr. Gray."
"I should like that awfully."
The painter bit his lip and walked over, cup in hand, to the picture. "I shall stay with the real Dorian," he said sadly. "Is it the real Dorian?" cried the original of the portrait, strolling across to him. "Am I really like that?" "Yes, you are just like that." "How wonderful, Basil! At least you are like it in appearance. But it will never alter," sighed Hallward. "That is something." "What a fuss people make about fidelity," exclaimed Lord Henry. "Why, even in love it is purely a question for physiology. It has nothing to do with our own will. Young men want to be faithful and are not. Old men want to be faithless and cannot. That is all one can say." "Don't go to the theatre tonight, Dorian," said Hallward. "Stop and dine with me." "I can't, Basil." "Why?" "Because I have promised Lord Henry Wotton to go with him." "He won't like you the better for keeping his promises. He always breaks his own. I beg you not to go." Dorian Gray laughed and shook his head. "I entreat you." The lad hesitated and looked over at Lord Henry, who was watching them from the tea table with an amused smile. "Pardon me. I must go, Basil," he answered. "Very well," said Hallward, and he went over and laid down his cup on the tray. "It is rather late, and, as you have to dress, you had better lose no time. Goodbye, Harry. Goodbye, Dorian. Come and see me soon. Come tomorrow." "Certainly." "You won't forget?" "No, of course not," cried Dorian. "And Harry?" "Yes, Basil." "Remember what I asked you when we were in the garden this morning." "I've forgotten it. I trust you." "I wish I could trust myself," said Lord Henry, laughing. "Come, Mr. Grey. My hansom is outside, and I can drop you at your own place. Goodbye, Basil. It has been a most interesting afternoon." As the door closed behind them, the painter flung himself down on the sofa, and a look of pain came into his face. Chapter 3. At 12:30 next day, Lord Henry Wotton strolled from Curzon Street over to the Albany to call on his uncle, Lord Fermor, a genial, if somewhat rough-mannered old bachelor, whom the outside world called selfish because it derived no particular benefit from him, but who was considered generous by society as he fed the people who amused him. His father had been our ambassador at Madrid when Isabella was young and prim unthought of, but had retired from the diplomatic service in a capricious moment of annoyance at not being offered the embassy at Paris, a post to which he considered that he was fully entitled by reason of his birth, his indolence, the good English of his dispatches, and his inordinate passion for pleasure. The son, who had been his father's secretary, had resigned along with his chief, somewhat foolishly as was thought at the time, and on succeeding some months later to the title, had set himself to the serious study of the great aristocratic art of doing absolutely nothing. He had two large townhouses, but preferred to live in chambers, as it was less trouble, and took most of his meals at his club. He paid some attention to the management of his collieries in the Midland counties, excusing himself for this taint of industry on the ground that the one advantage of having coal was that it enabled a gentleman to afford the decency of burning wood on his own hearth. In politics, he was a Tory, except when the Tories were in office, during which period he roundly abused them for being a pack of radicals. He was a hero to his valet, who bullied him, and a terror to most of his relations, who he bullied in turn. Only England could have produced him, and he always said that the country was going to the dogs. His principles were out of date, but there were a good deal to be said for his prejudices. When Lord Henry entered the room, he found his uncle sitting in a rough shooting coat, smoking a cheroot, and grumbling over the times. "Well, Harry," said the old gentleman, "what brings you out so early? I thought you dandies never got up until 2, and were not visible till 5. Pure family affection, I assure you, Uncle George. I want to get something out of you." "Money, I suppose," said Lord Fermor, making a wry face. "Well, sit down and tell me all about it. Young people nowadays imagine that money is everything." "Yes," murmured Lord Henry, settling his buttonhole in his coat. and when they grow older, they know it. But I don't want money. It's only people who pay their bills that want that, Uncle George, and I never pay mine. Credit is the capital of a younger son, and one lives charmingly upon it. Besides, I always deal with the Dartmoor's tradesmen, and consequently they never bother me. What I want is information. Not useful information, of course. Useless information. Well, I can tell you anything that is an English blue book, Harry, although these fellows nowadays write a lot of nonsense. When I was in the diplomatic, things were much better, but I hear they let them now in now by examination. What can you expect? Examinations, sir, a pure humbug, from beginning to end. If a man is a gentleman, he knows quite enough, and if he's not a gentleman, whatever he knows is bad for him. Mr. Dorian Gray does not belong to blue books, Uncle George, said Lord Henry languidly. Mr. Dorian Gray, who is he? Asked Lord Ferner, knitting his bushy wise eyebrows. That is what I have come to learn, Uncle George. Or rather, I know who he is. He is the last Lord Kelso's grandson. His mother was a Devereux, Lady Margaret Devereux. I want you to tell me about his mother. What was she like? Whom did she marry? You've known nearly everybody in your time, so you might have known her. I'm very much interested in Mr. Grey at present. I've only just met him.